Okay, hello everyone. Nice to see you again on our second talk of the Israeli Studies Seminar for Trinity Term. Our speaker today, Dr. Yair Berlin from Cambridge University, completed his PhD at the Program for Hermeneutics and Cultural Studies at Bar-Ilan University, focusing on religious emotions in the Lithuanian Ultra-Orthodox community. And he is currently a British Academy Newton International Fellow at the University of Cambridge, as we said, and a research associate at Sydney Sussex College. His research, which we will hear about in the following hour and so, focuses on the emotional dimensions of the Zionist negation of the diaspora. We're really happy to have you here. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much, and thank you for everyone. Coming. Let me know if I need to speak louder or.
No.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. The answer is yes. Okay, I'll try. Okay. Let's start. Feelings are not as old as time. Just as there was first instant when someone rubbed two sticks together to make a spark, there was a first time for joy was felt and a first time for sadness. People became addicted to feeling. They struggled to uncover new emotions. New kinds of joy were forged, along with new kinds of sadness, the eternal disappointment of life as it is, the relief of unexpected reprieve, the fear of dying. Even now, all possible feelings do not yet exist. So there are still those that lies beyond our capacity and our imagination. From time to time, when a piece of music no one has ever written, or a painting no one has ever painted, or someone else impossible to predict, fathom, or yet described, take place, a new feeling enters the world. And then for the millionth time in the history of feeling, the heart surges and absorbs the impact. This poetic text from the novel The History of Love by Nicole Krauss articulates an insight that has been increasingly elaborated upon over the past few decades in various fields of humanities about emotions. The basic claim that emerged from these studies is that not only ideas, but emotions too, are cultural artifacts, as Geertz says. Consequently, emotions have a history. The ways they are understood, expressed, and even felt changes over time and across cultures. To be more specific, it can be said that the study of emotions challenges three common Western assumptions, or mainly Western assumptions, about emotions. The first is that emotions are natural and therefore universal. According to this assumption, there is a set of basic emotions, love, anger, fear, sadness, etc., that the capacity to feel them is shared by all humans. Second assumption is that emotions are personal and originated from within the individual. Emotions are perceived as a symbol of that defined authenticity and inner truth. And the third assumption is that the dichotomy that exists between emotion and thought. According to this perception, rational thinking is unaffected or should be unaffected by emotions, by emotional bias. Emotions are recognized with impulsive and uncalculated actions. These three assumptions are, in fact, myths about emotions that shape how people relate to their emotions mostly in Western society. In practice, studies reveal that the set of emotions varies across culture and throughout history. Words like anger and love, as well as the general category of emotion itself, function specifically within their cultural and historical context. Emotions such as love and anger and hate have undergone radical redefinitions and have been experienced differently over time. Moreover, emotions do not merely arise from within us. We learn to feel them, to name them, to perform them, within social and cultural frameworks. And lastly, emotions are an inseparable part of how we understand the world, and are intrinsic part of how of the process of cognition. But even if the cultural the cultural nature of seemingly simple emotions like fear and love may appear counterintuitive, there are emotions whose cultural character and historical viability are much more evident. This is particularly true for national emotions, which are directed towards social loyalty and a sense of belonging to a collective with unique historical and cultural traits. While the historical dimension of such emotions is easier to recognize, these type of emotions also raises a distinctive set of problems. For start, what exactly are national emotions? Can we identify a specific set of emotions that characterize national belonging? Or can any emotion become national? Moreover, are these emotions unique in nature, or do they function similarly to emotions in other domains? For instance, is the love for the nation similar to or connected with romantic love or with the love of God? I will attempt to answer some of these questions in this talk by examining the case of the Zionist movement, which sought to establish a national framework in Palestine for the Jewish people, a national homeland in Palestine for Jewish people. I'm going to look at some of the emotional concepts within Zionism. In some cases, I will rely on existing research on emotions in Zionism, and I will analyze them from the perspective of national emotions. And in other cases, I will draw from my own research projects. I would like to begin with the concept of emotional restraint. Intuitively, when we think of national emotions, I think we think about powerful and epic and pathos-filled feelings like patriotism, love of the nation and the homeland, or the fervor of a battlefield that articulates in these pictures. These are emotions that are typically evoked by national symbols, or often evoked by national symbols and anthems. However, contrary to this intuition, national loyalty does not always have to be expressed in such vivid terms. This argument was made in a slightly different context by Billing's classical study of banal nationalism, though he didn't explicitly focus on the emotional dimension. And what I would like to speak about, I would like to do in this talk, is maybe to unpack and extend this claim within the framework of national emotional life. One of the central emotional ethoses in Zionist discourse can be described, and I use a term that was coined by Chizki Shoam and Matan Bord, as an anti-emotional ethos. The notion that the nation requires its members, particularly its men, to maintain emotional restraint and overcome emotional turmoil. For instance, the poet David Shimoni wrote during the 1921 riots in Jaffa, and I quote, "Do not mourn, do not weep at such times. Do not lower your head. Work, work. In dire moment, work twice as hard. Create twice as much. Plant and prune, clear stones and fence, and clear and pave the path of freedom for the day of light. On the path of suffering goes redemption, and blood cries out to the soul of the nation, awaken and act. Be redeemed and redeem," end quote. This text articulates the construction of a masculine and stoic nationalism characterized by practicality and measured rational management of emotions. In time of distress and loss, there is no time for emotional breakdowns, mourning the dead or acknowledging the horror or collective or individual suffering. One must continue pushing towards the goal. This ethos was prevalent, though not exclusively, among early Zionist settlers who were expected to suppress their emotions for the sake of dedication to the national effort. It was also part of the attempt to create new Zionist Jew, distinct from the diasporic Jew, who was perceived as sentimental and soft and feminine, as these two construct. Here is the new Jew, and here is the old Jew, which are. Can we see his like? We can see the weakness, and that was again. The connotation of sentimentality and softness, etc. So the first thing we see already is that the study of nationalism and emotion in general might not only need to look on emotions per se, but also at those places where emotions are blocked or denied in favor of rationality. With that being said, I'll go back to... as I argue in the outset, it's essential to question the supposed separation between rationality and emotion. Rationality, the notion that pure that can be exist a pure realm of restraint and practicality of thinking that it detached from emotions, is itself a myth. As human, I think we always feel our thoughts also and think our emotions. It's never completely separated. So I think we need to look more closely at the attributes of rationality and restraint, because even though those terms are defined as the very antithesis of emotional, they nevertheless often conceal a deeply emotional position. Let's examine it again and read its last words. On the path of suffering goes redemption, and blood cries out to the soul of the nation, awaken and act, be redeemed and redeem. I think it's hard not to hear the emotional pathos embedded in these lines, the stirring emotional resonance between the cry of the blood and the soul of the nation. Another point here, that the agricultural work that Shimoni encouraged this practical thing, despite, and he argued we should keep to the practice despite the tragedy, also carries emotional fervor. To illustrate this, it is useful to compare this text with Simcha Ben Sion's deception of the agricultural labor in the Zionist settlements in Palestine. I'm quoting again. I am a Levite, and have made myself a harp on which I will train my fingers, a shiny harp of pure silver, and you too, the land of Israel, have seen it in my hand. Yes, it is the hoe that I bear on my shoulder before sunrise. Sincere, sincere are my words, my hoe is my harp. And see each man with his harp, each man with the hoe, and each with his heart's desire, we have set out to our devastated land, we have come. End quote. This romantic description links and these quotes are coming from the book of Boaz Neumann about land and design, early Zionism. This romantic description linked field labor to the ritual music that was played in the Jewish temple by the Levites. Agricultural work, as a national act, was imbued with the drama of romantic quest, brimming with intense emotions. And like any romantic pursuit, it was an ethos that often intertwined with disappointment and the inability to fully realize it. Yitzhak Lamdan captured this sense of longing in his deception of the erotic anticipation of the encounter with the land. I quote again. Soil, I but listened to the wine song in your veins, but it come not to my lips. Why did your wine did not numb me, so I could rise from kneeling at your side? Why have you not bared your breast on my mouth? End quote. Here we see the attribution of romantic qualities to the national endeavor. National endeavor is being framed as a pursuit of self-fulfillment and erotic quest. This is not romantic encounter between two humans, rather more akin to a discourse of religious love. It is a romantic encounter between the national subject and a kind of a mythical national entity, embodied in these texts as the land itself, where the subject is required to shed bodily fluids of blood and sweat in order to unite with the land and the nation. It is far removed from the ostensible discourse of rational stoicism and denial of human emotions. And again, if we go back to the end of Shimoni's reading the end of Shimoni's when he tried to speak about avoiding emotions, to not to mourn but to not to weep but to work. I think here the work is emotionally loaded, so it's not really an act of restraint, but it's an act of trying to feel something else instead of mourning. So I think we can find evidence of this patriotic emotions in the calling for work too. In other words, the quest for emotional restraint and the nationality here is an undercover for the national emotions of love, fervor, and patriotism. And yet, national feeling does not always need to reach such heated extremes. I would like to move a little bit outside of the Zionist case for a moment and look at the British stiff upper lip, which is, I think, perhaps it's the most quintessential expression of the emotional restraint as national trait. And one famous representation of the stiff upper lips has become part of the popular culture. And this is we show a short clip from the 1937 Hollywood musical, A Damsel in Distress. And this ethos was vividly portrayed in this clip. And I'll stop it here, there. Continue with this dance for a little while.
We can try it
later. Yeah, we can try it later. The practical part of this talk will be later. Oh, sorry. I'll try to present it again. In this song, the ethos of restraint, coolness, and suppressing of emotions such as pain and suffering is shown to blend with other emotions. It's a very emotional song that do not appear to contradict it. Courage, fight spirit, cheerfulness, and even happiness, these are all embedded in the notion of emotional restraint. and I will discuss happiness later. So I think these emotions stand out from this clip, as does the implicit connection between restraint and the emotional field and dignity, pride, and honor that this clip also plays at these emotions too. From the perspective of the stiff upper lips, sadness, tears, and mourning are the emotional villains, representing breakdown, loss of restraint, and control. So it's a specific emotions that this ethos is targeting, not all emotions. And the specific emotions, again, is the emotions that are linked to breakdown and loss of restraint, and mainly sadness and maybe shame also. On the other hand, courage, cheerfulness, and honor, these are good emotions that consider part of the, and they can coexist with rationality and restraint. These are not emotional of release, nor are they overly warm or intense. Now, if we take these ideas of courage and honor back to the analysis of Zionism, we're drawn to one of its fundamental elements. As various studies have shown, Zionism can be seen as a movement driven by the desire to restore or establish Jewish honor. Jewish life in exile, perceived as dishonorable, one where Jews depended on the mercy and the goodwill of others. The concept of Zionism as restoration of honor aligned with the motivation of that drove the movement founder, Theodor Herzl. In a scene from his novel Altneuland, which depicts the an utopian Jewish state, the protagonist, Friedrich Leuenberg, visits the rebuilt Jewish temple and recalls the dishonorable state of the Jewish people before the establishment of the Jewish state. I quote again from this book. The time when Jews had been ashamed of everything that was Jewish, when they believed that they looked more aristocratic when they hid their Jewishness. How could they wonder that they were despised when they themselves despised their own origins? All around him, Friedrich could see the signs of how it had come about. Jewry had a look so different now, because it was no longer ashamed of itself. The strong, the free, the successful had also returned home. Friedrich suddenly, in a flash, saw the meaning of the temple. Only here had the Jews again developed a free commonwealth in which they could work for the good of mankind. In the ghetto, they were without honor, without rights, without justice, without defense. When they left the ghetto, they ceased to be Jews. Yet a man to be a man must have both freedom and feeling of community. Only when the Jews had both could they rebuild the house of the invisible and almighty God. End quote. And to fully understand Herzl, this text, I think, it is necessary to challenge the assumption that emotions arise from within us. Honor is, I think, exemplifies an emotion that does not emerge from within oneself, but is granted from the outside, and in Herzl's notion, dependent on national affiliation. As can be seen in the cluster Herzl constructing this text, linking honor, right, justice, and defense. In this text, there is an imminent connection between the national entity and the emotion of honor. Without a nation, there can be no honor. Flags, anthem, armies, symbols, and ceremonies are not mere expressions of honor or way of or way to represent, replicate, or amplify honor. It is the very definition of honor itself. And I think one key issue here is that this text is blurring the boundaries between different forms of honor and respect. In an abstract level, we can There is different types of respect, and we can that is reflecting different words we have for honor, respect, dignity, etc. And intuitively, and I think often with the legal discourse as well, a sense of dignity may be perceived not as dependent of any specific social context. It is feeling inherent to being human. National honor, on the other hand, might appear to be more bestowed emotion. However, in this text, and I think this without honor, without right, without justice, without defense, we can see that these two apparently very different type of respect, intrinsic human dignity and extrinsic emotional honor, are inherently linked. Herzl suggests here that honor forms the foundation of the basic human dignity. Without national honor, there can be no freedom, liberty, justice, or even, by extension, rationality. For Herzl, a person without a nation lacks not only honor, which is maybe more implicit, and respect, but also dignity. As nationalism here is the balance between personal freedom and community. The elements that, in Herzl's view, makes a person truly human, or to be faithful to his own words, perhaps I should say a man, truly a man. So Herzl linking basic human dignity to national existence reveal a broader pattern. The way nationalism may shape and redefine even the most fundamental emotions and experience. Again, it is easy for us to associate emotions such as honor or of love, or love of the homeland with ideas of nationalism. But if we look more closely, we can see that even more basic and what can be considered as natural emotions are constructed and shaped by national ideas. And I will give one example from the emotion of fear. A fundamental motivation for the Zionist movement was the sense of distress experienced by Jews, particularly in Eastern Europe. Jews were afraid of losing their rights and freedom at best, and they bore an existential dread of pogroms at worst. On the rhetorical, one of the rhetorical strategies employed by the Zionist movement was that of a rescue mission for Jews, asserting that those who did not support Zionism would bear responsibility for the impending catastrophe. In this sense, Zionism can be viewed as an extension of perhaps the most natural and survival-driven emotion, fear. This argument is not exclusive to Zionism. Fear is often identified as a significant driver in historical analysis. Frequently, historical actions and shifts are explained throughout the lens of fear, which is perceived as a primary motivation. The explanatory power of fear stems from its simplicity and self-evident nature. There seems to be nothing more straightforward than asserting that an action was taken out of survival instinct. It's easy to say he did that, or a group did that, or this happens because of fear. It's a very simple and straightforward explanation that is often taken for granted. Returning to the Zionist context, alternative explanation from the Zionism, such as the view that Herzl, that I just presented, that Herzl project was driven by honor rather than fear, often emerged later in the process of research. First, we say it was because of fear, because of pogrom, and then studies shows that other emotions maybe were more important, such as, again, the emotion of honor. But the beginning was a more survivalist interpretation of Zionism, as the idea, maybe some of you know, that Herzl project came from the Dreyfus trail. However, should fear be regarded as such an obvious and straightforward motivator? I would like to challenge that, even that. Fear itself is far more complex than it may seem. Pogrom and existential threats to Jewish life in Europe did not originate in the end of the 19th and the beginning of 20th centuries. Jews has faced and dealt with these threats in various ways long before the rise of Zionism. And one of the defining features of modernity was the perception of fear as an emotion that should be confronted, and it result and the resulting aspiration to build human framework in which fear did not exist. It's a modern idea. This aspiration is not obvious and should not be taken for granted. There are cultural frameworks where fear is seen as an integral part of life, even sometimes considered as normal or, in certain cases, such as religious fear, desirable. However, the modern Western discourse, again, there is exceptions to that, but in general, it was characterized by an anti-fear campaign. As exemplifies, I think Rosenfeld's famous dictum, the only thing we need to fear is fear itself, is embodiment of this notion. Fear is the villain. The Zionist discourse can be understood as part of this campaign. Consider, for instance, Rachel Feierberg, what Rachel Feierberg wrote in her memories of the pogroms of 1881 and 1882. I quote him again. Life began to freeze. The heart fell silent at every rustle and sound. People do not longer felt the usual joys or sorrow. They wandered the streets like shadows, their eyes filled with fear, scanning all around for hidden dangers. There is no suffering in the world like the dread of pogrom. Death itself is nothing compared to the terror of death. End quote. This portrayal of the dread of a pogrom as a problem more severe in a way than the pogrom itself represent more the modern disposition, I think. When reading pre-modern and more traditional accounts of the pogroms or of riots in chronicles and prayers, fear certainly appears. It's not; it is there, but it's not the central emotion. More prominent is grief, mourning, and lamentation. For example, let us examine a passage from the chronicle Even Metzula that described the riots of the 17th century. That this quote refers to the moment where of hearing about impending riots, the moment of fear. Like that's what that we should expect. I quote, "In every province, whithersoever the oppressor command and his decree came, there was great rejoicing among Ukrainians and great mourning among the nobles and Jews." This is using the words of Megillat Esther. "And fasting and weeping and bitter cry and repentance and prayer and charity." End quote. Here, the riot is framed within the system of sin, punishment, and divine justice, and within the emotional script of repentance, the fasting, weeping, and lamentation, intended to avert the harsh decree. The place of fear here is implicit. Fear is central in what leads to mourning, lamentation, and repentance. The response of weeping is the declared aim of the chronicle Valley of Tear, Emek HaBacha. And at the beginning of the chronicle, it's declared that the aim of this chronicle is to evoke feeling of sadness and tears in its readers. And I quote again, "The name of this book is The Valley of Tears, for truly it is as its names. Every reader will be desolate, will weep over the events of our people. His eyes will always shed tears until they they render him a fountain. He will raise his eyes upwards and say, 'How long the striker will strike him? Awaken, my Lord, command my Redeemer, and redeem this despised, weakened people.'" End quote. By contrast, in modern memories, Suffering is symbolized less by grief and more by fear and humiliation. Accordingly, in its modern orientation, the Zionist project thought to eradicate Jewish fear. Labeling Jewish fear as an emotional demon to be fought positions fear as a national emotion in two frameworks. The first framework emphasizes the unique sense of fear which defined the experience of being a Jew in the exile. As Yaakov Fichman described in his... Yaakov Fichman described in his childhood memories regarding the memories reading Jewish chronicles of the pogroms. I'm quoting. During childhood, we read in horror the books of Valley of Tears, Shevet Yehuda and Even Metzula. They cast the first shadow upon us, lying bare the abyss for the first time. And yet they appear to us as nightmares of the past, like a world sinking away, something not to be inferred upon the present. Only when Father was not at home did the night sounds of the suburb momentarily shake the heart. And that Israeli fear arose, the fear of generations emerging from those historical pamphlets. End quote. So the Zionist cultural shift aimed to create a new Jew who was without such fear. And again, here Fichman, he reads these chronicles as a horror books, not as books that create lamentation and sadness and weeping. The main emotion for him here is fear, and not the the lamentation that I think traditionally these books were evoked. Within this framework, fear is framed as Jewish identity issue. The problem of fear is particularly Jewish, and the Zionist story involving fear was understood as a unique Jewish project aimed to addressing specific Jewish issues, such as exile and anti-Semitism, persecution throughout the years, etc. However, fear should, as I started already to show, fear should also be understood as a national emotion within a broader framework, not only as a Jewish problem, outside the specificity of Jewish experience. Within this second framework, the Zionist issue with fear represents the birth of a security ethos typical of modern nationalism. As noted, the discourse of eradicating fear is not unique to Zionism, but also aligned with broader central trends in Western culture. Even outside the Zionist context, it is often the nation state which is assumed to be the responsible of eliminating fear. Citizens of modern states often believe that the state is accountable for their sense of security in a very general way. And thus, the emotion of fear often situates the citizen within the framework of the state and the nation. Fear is decoded within the national context. This claim holds true not only for fear or clearly security fears such as the fear of wars or fear of terrorist attacks, but also I think for more everyday fears like fears of crime, of health issues, driving in poorly lit planned roads, or even tripping on a broken sidewalk. All these little fears are the nation and some kind of one of the nation should be responsible for that. The nation state is responsible for the citizens' freedom of living without fear. In a very general way. And I think in order to fully understand this and grasp the significance of this last argument, we need to understand the term security itself in a much broader sense than it's usually interpreted. And I would like to advance this claim through, I will discuss several sources that feature in recently published book by Orit Rosin, which explores the emotional world of Israeli-Arab conflict in the early decades of the states. So it's a little bit forward ahead in history, not from Zionism, but I think I found in this book a very very good example to what I wanted to say. What is the emotional experience encapsulated in the word security? On the surface, security is a cold emotional state. Again, going back to emotional restraint. It's a state of calm. One can describe security not as an emotion, but as absence of certain specific emotions, certain specific negative emotions, primarily fear and anxiety and other types of fear. However, as I would like to argue, security is far more emotionally charged, and that there is a variety of emotions that play a role in the drama of trying to live without fear, which is the drama of security. It's a much bigger emotional drama, and there is much more it's much more rich in terms of the emotions it raises. The disco of security is a very thick and relates to many emotions, not only to fear. Let's read a testimony from one of the volunteers that defended the frontier kibbutzim in Esri in early Israel decades. I'm quoting, "We did it because of an inner imperative that of the heart that commanded us to give with all of our bodies and all of our might to reinforce the country's security, as the integrity of our lives and those of our family depend on its security. When we erect a fence, pour concrete for a bomb shelter under the fierce summer sun, our heart fills with a feeling of satisfaction." End quote. Security is a matter of the heart. It evokes satisfaction in a sense of belonging and lends life its integrity. The connection forged between the land and the home in the concept of homeland is more than a metaphor in this context. The emotion associated with the homeland, security are similar to the warm emotion that may arise in the safety of the home. I'll read another quote from a letter written by a woman in Kiryat Yam during the waiting period. I quote, "We are experiencing hours full of anxiety. I prayed to God for peace. Israel, our precious land, must endure. It is so beautiful, so sweet to live in Israel. Here I finally found what I lacked in other lands, security, the joy of listening to the radio, to live with Jews." End quote. What strikes me about this quote is the framing of Israel as a source of security, which remains unshaken despite the emotional roller coaster that life in Israel often offered its citizens. Even at its most difficult moments, Israel is still perceived as the only place that provides security for Jews. No matter how shaky its walls, the home is the only option for security, and there is no other option. Security is a rare commodity for Jews, but the homeland is the only place that might supply it. Security is an object of desire, the fulfillment of a dream. It's a joy here. A teacher from the frontier kibbutzim expresses explicitly, and I quote again, "There is nothing like that feeling. It is a feeling of joy, the feeling of security. If we are compelled to fight, we will win. It is a feeling that overcomes your heart." End quote. I think it is worth pausing here to note the Hebrew word for security, bitachon. In the rabbinic tradition, this word carries the meaning of one of the highest religious virtues, derived from deep faith in divine providence. This faith is independent of circumstances, resting on the belief that whatever happens is for the best, and it is intrinsically connected to feeling of closeness to the love of God. It is a very warm emotional state, not like what we think about security. Bitachon is much more, it's much more warm. And I think it might be appropriate to think about the concept of the feeling of security in the nation state concept in a manner similar to this religious virtue. Security is also a state of faith in the country. To conclude, Let us return to the question of the nature of emotional, of national emotions, and whether this category refers to a distinct set of emotions or whether any emotions can become national. I'm inclined towards the latter option. Whether we like it or not, I think, our national affiliation will influence our emotional understanding, or at least nationalism will have a significance in how we conceptualize and experience our emotions. This is because we interpret our emotions through our cultural and institutional framework. Belonging to any cultural institution, be it familial, national, or social, inevitably deeply elicit and shapes our emotional lives. The Zionist movement is an excellent example of that shaping of national emotional consciousness in its aim to construct a new Jew. Honor, love, courage, but also fear, happiness, and security. These are all were affected by the Zionist idea of the emotional traits that Zionism thought to cultivate in Jewish life, where opposing emotion to honor, love, and courage, like were often attributed to the diasporic Jew. In Zionism, in that sense, was driven, among other things, by new emotionology, new attitude and standards regarding emotions, and such again, fear, honor, shame, and love, and their place in society, and how they should be expressed. Fundamentally, Zionism sought to free Judaism and the Jewish people from the negative emotions, or specific negative emotions, of exile, and bring them to the positive emotions of the homeland, or what is considered positive emotional sphere in the homeland. It is essential to emphasize again that this Zionist pursuit of happiness, as we can call it, or Zionist pursuit of joy, did not imply a total rejection of pain and negative emotions. The Zionist struggle for the life in the homeland was expected to include suffering and loss, and there were negative emotions that the Jews were allowed, or is still allowed, to feel in the homeland. But not all of the negative emotions are equal. I think that the new Jew could endure pain and loss, but must not live in fear and shame. Fear and shame is the breach of the Zionist dream, and that must be addressed. The role of Zionism, and accordingly the Zionist definition of happiness, I think, was to fight these emotions and replace them with love, honor, and security. And this emotional project was part of the broader modern Western agenda, which often aimed to establish a happy humanity. The Zionist project of liberating Jews from the suffering of exile reflects the fact that the pursuit of happiness as a national project is a characteristic of modernity. This is evident from examples like the American Declare of Independence, or the various happiness indices that frame happiness within the boundaries of countries. And the idea that there is a national state of happiness is something, in a way, very weird, but I think it's framed happiness as something that happens within the country, the boundaries of countries. The modern pursuit of happiness is often perceived as a national and political mission, not just personal or familial one. Achieving happiness relies on the collective effort of the nation. Thus, happiness is yet another example of seemingly simple and personal and banal emotion that must also be analyzed and understood through the lens of nationalism. And here I will end. Thank you very much.